The presentation of anarchism, a social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual, of the human race. The emancipation.
Anarchist Essays is brought to you by Loughborough University's Anarchism Research Group. For more information on the ARG, see the link in the show notes or follow us on Twitter at ARGLBORO.
Alexander Berkman's Anti-Prison Anarchism by Nolan Bennett. What is a prison? The anarchist Alexander Berkman asked in 1906 during his first public address since his 14 years incarcerated in Pennsylvania. He answers, "A prison is the model on the lines of which civilized society is built." Though with bombast befitting the radical politics of the era, Berkman's analyses of incarceration would make him an apt interlocutor among those who study and struggle against prisons today. Born amid the clash between populists and czarists in Imperial Russia, Berkman emigrated in 1888 to join the equally volatile contests between industrialists and activists in urban America. After working with several anarchist groups, Berkman became notorious in 1892 for his attempted assassination of the Carnegie Steel Mill manager during the strike in Homestead, Pennsylvania. He and Emma Goldman hoped that their attempt would provoke workers to revolution, but Berkman failed to kill Henry Clay Frick, and upon his arrest, he served 14 of the 22 years sentenced at Western State Penitentiary and a nearby workhouse. A few years after his release, comrades encouraged Berkman to publish an account of his experiences in prison. The resulting 1912 Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist offered an extensive account of incarceration while pointing toward the anarchist politics and theory that Berkman would continue developing over the following years through his and Goldman's deportation in 1919 and his death in 1936. Those who read his memoirs believed the book testament not only to the mind of an anarchist, as novelist Jack London wrote, but the unthinkable cruelty and lunatic management of our prisons. "If people read this book carefully, it will tend to do away with prisons," wrote colleague Hutchins Hapgood in its introduction. In 1970, a new introduction urged readers to apply Berkman's analyses to trends that we now recognize as a flashpoint in the rise of mass incarceration. This essay's goal is, first, to convince you to read Berkman's prison memoirs, which is an underappreciated and surprisingly relevant work. My second goal, admittedly more formidable, is to trace through Berkman's developing analysis of prisons an unresolved tension, which exemplifies, I think, a larger tension within U.S. prison politics today. That tension is between two approaches to the prison. The first approach to prisons and prison memoirs positions Berkman as a political prisoner, drawing upon anarchist debates over violence and the anticipation of political persecution that he imported from Imperial Russia to industrial America. Berkman's accounts of his arrest, trial, and incarceration in the first part of the book present him as a martyred hero for whom prison is proof of his revolutionary deeds, but not itself a site of politics. Berkman described his 1892 attack on Henry Clay Frick as an attentat, a political assassination intended to propel the working class into revolution. Otherwise known as the propaganda of the deed, the attentat was a form of direct action debated by anarchists Bakunin, Errico Malatesta, and Peter Kropotkin, among others. According to Berkman, the attentat would show the masses the ruling class's vulnerability. "The people," comprised Berkman, "the universe," he wrote. Continuing, "the rest are parasites who have no right to exist." Once in jail, though, Berkman is struck by others' rejection of the assassination. Others jailed presumed that he acted out of personal grievance. An anarchist outside the prison, like Johann Most and Benjamin Tucker, also criticized Berkman, and he's further humiliated to learn that Frick, in fact, survived the assault. Confronted by tyrants and traitors, Berkman depicts himself here as a political prisoner, punished for the ideas behind his deed. Before the attack, Berkman interrupts scenes of the strike with childhood memories of how his nihilist uncle was exiled and sentenced to death amid broad political retaliation, combined with pogroms against Russian Jews. Upon arriving in Pittsburgh, Berkman registers as Rakhmatov, a character from imprisoned intellectual Nikolai Chernyshevsky's 1863 novel, What is to be Done?, a book whose interpretation inspired attacks on the Russian Tsar. And in describing his assassination attempt, Berkman invokes language from the equally influential nihilist Sergei Nechayev's Revolutionary Catechism of 1869. The first chapters of Berkman's prison memoirs portray his punishment as though he were one of the many iconoclasts incarcerated in the Peter and Paul Fortress, the primary tool of Russian state persecution during the long 19th century. Chernyshevsky, Nechayev, as well as Berkman's other influences, Kropotkin and Bakunin, all served time in this St. Petersburg prison. Inspired by this history, Berkman initially depicts the Pennsylvania prison as a state tool for suppressing radicalism and a signifier of his revolutionary status. When comrades accused of aiding the Attentat, Karl Nold and Henry Bauer, arrive at Riverside, Berkman writes that he's now closer to, he says, the environment of political prisoners in Europe. Portraying himself as though imprisoned not in Pittsburgh but St. Petersburg, Berkman describes the Attentat and prison as but two tools in an ideational struggle between the state and the revolutionist on the people's behalf. America in this era certainly had its tools for political persecution. Amid a rising wave of anti-radical hysteria, Berkman was galvanized by the trial of eight anarchists for their involvement in the 1886 riots at Chicago's Haymarket Square, a trial where the state prosecutor urged the jury that anarchy is on trial. By approaching his incarceration as though he were explicitly persecuted for his ideals, however, Berkman's first approach is poorly calibrated to the use of legal procedure in the United States. Though his attorneys and allies caution against it, Berkman plans to use his trial, he writes, to talk to the people. Refusing to call witnesses at court, Berkman stands to deliver his speech in German, but the interpreter struggles to translate, and the judge silences Berkman before sentencing him. It's not simply that Berkman's attack and attempts at exoneration fail. The greater consequence of this first approach is that Berkman's attention is drawn away from the prison itself and its inhabitants. Just as the Attentat discriminates between the people and everyone else, seizing the status of political prisoner demotes others as traitors to the cause or common criminals. At one point, when Berkman is working through depression, he blanches at the notion of seeking a greeting from a passing convict, saying, "They are not of my world. They do not belong to the people." For the political prisoner Berkman, the people are always outside the prison, with only parasites or the politically persecuted inside. And it will take much of the prison memoirs for him to see prison differently. The majority of the text covers Berkman's 13 years at the Riverside location of Western State Penitentiary, and it doesn't take long for him to better understand the poor conditions that face all imprisoned people. He describes himself as worn in body and soul. He gets a job in the workshop, but he finds his health worsened by hard labor. When the warden sends him to the dungeon as punishment, Berkman portrays himself, he writes, cast into the stony bowels of the underground. When he's returned to solitary row, the warden withholds his access to books, photographs, exercise, or communication with others. Through these experiences, Berkman develops a second approach to prisons. He shifts attention from himself as political prisoner to the politics of prisons. 3 months into his sentence, he writes, "I had always thought of prison as a place where, in a measure, nature comes into its own. Social distinctions are abolished, artificial barriers destroyed, no need of hiding one's thoughts and emotions. One could be his real self, shedding all hypocrisy and artifice at the prison gates. But how different is this life? It is full of deceit, sham, and Pharisaism, an aggravated counterpart of the outside world. This realization signals a developing view that unites political prisoners with common criminals. Berkman takes up work cleaning cells, which brings him closer to other prisoners, working to understand the thieves, tramps, con men as reflecting the very capitalist institutions he opposes. He analyzes guards, their formal and informal training, writing, "Daily I behold the machinery at work, grinding and pulverizing, brutalizing the officers, dehumanizing the inmates." By this approach, prison is not merely a tool of state persecution. It is an institutional extension of capitalism, the state, and other authorities. Struggle doesn't stop at the prison gates, political prisoners then silenced among the refuse. No, Berkman discovers here the people's political potential behind bars. With fellow comrades Nold and Bauer, Berkman begins an underground magazine called The Prison Blossoms, and he takes on new contributors and readers from across the prison, the resulting magazine including testimonies, philosophy, memoir, humor. Berkman also observes and assists organized resistance. For example, workers strike after bad meat shows up for supper, he writes, and a later investigation of New York's facilities inspires a similar movement among Berkman's fellow prisoners. Rather than stand by, though, Berkman offers to testify before an investigation committee, and he gathers and conceals evidence of abuse. When authorities whitewash the investigation, Berkman works with others inside and out to publicize the prison's brutality. A final stirring example of Berkman's new empathy are the numerous intimate relations he develops with other men. While Berkman is first repulsed by one prisoner's coercive relationships with younger men, he fosters his own queer connections after sent to the dungeon. There he describes the warmth kindled with his neighbor, Johnny Davis, writing, "With a glow of pleasure, I become aware of the note of tenderness in his voice." The two converse, and though they cannot touch, they grow, Berkman says, openly tender and affectionate. They confess that they would kiss were they free. Later, Berkman forms a similar relationship with Russell, a young man who becomes caught up in Berkman's escape attempt and then dies tragically after a medical accident. And his last words are a goodbye to Berkman. By this point, Johnny had also passed away, and Berkman wishes that a rosebud will timidly burst and flower from his convict grave. Drawing upon these experiences, Berkman would later give lectures with titles like Homosexuality and Sex Life in Prison once he was released. With these experiences, Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist transforms from an attentater's autobiography to a book about doomed men. Prison is no holding pen for political prisoners and criminals. It is an extension of American institutions and activism. When he learns that radical Gaetano Bresci has executed the Italian king, Berkman's mind is on a cellmate who bled to death. He writes, "Here, all around me, 1,000 unfortunates daily suffer. They bleed and struggle and suicide with a desperate cry for a little sunshine and life. How shall they be helped? How helped amid the injustice and brutality of a society whose chief monuments are prisons?" This politics of prisons approach is evident throughout Berkman's works while incarcerated and after. In an essay from The Prison Blossoms, published after his release, Berkman theorized punishment as a modern form of civilized revenge, he wrote, that it produces the criminal as an enemy of society. "No amount of punishment," he writes, "can obviate crime so long as existing social conditions drive man to it." Though drawn from his own experiences incarcerated, this developed approach to prisons put Berkman in conversation with others like Kropotkin, Voltairine de Cleyre, and, of course, Emma Goldman. And it also typified a growing anarchist and leftist discourse about crime and punishment to challenge the criminological defense of prisons. All of this, I think, makes Berkman's prison memoirs a fascinating text. And yet, toward the end of that book, and through much of his later activism, Berkman remained ambivalent, wavering back and forth between the political prisoner and politics of prisons approaches. For example, in his first speech, after leaving the workhouse on May 18, 1906, he castigated the prison and its place in modern society. Yet he also expressed gratitude to be away from what he called the select circle of thieves, which included prisoners and guards. He said he was thankful to be back with honest laboring men. Though newly appreciative of prisoners' experiences, Berkman continued to suggest that anarchists must liberate the masses from the ideas of capitalism, religion, and law. "Has persecution ever stifled the voice of truth?" he asked his audience after leaving the workhouse. He accused readers of a later book, "You submit to the domination of boss, judge, and government because of their power to deprive you of work, to ruin your business, to put you in prison." Messianic rhetoric in the prison memoirs similarly suggests Berkman's commitment to a political prisoner approach. Within one chapter, he decries how religion weaves the spell of awe in modern society, and yet declares his hope for what he calls the revolutionary messiah. At the end of the book, he describes his own emancipation as a resurrection, using similar language to describe Nold and Bauer. He writes that resurrection trembles within other imprisoned friends whom he once described as parasites, almost devoid of humanity. But are these resurrections proof that the people are their own messiah, not Berkman? Or are they another of the anarchists' miracles, just as Christ resurrected Lazarus? Once out of prison, Berkman did continue writing and lecturing on the politics of prisons. Yet more persistent throughout Berkman's later activism was his advocacy for political prisoners, support that resurrected the distinction between common criminals and persecuted dissidents. The March 15, 1917 issue of his journal, The Blast, featured articles on the trials of Warren K. Billings and Thomas J. Mooney for their alleged involvement with a bombing at a pro-war parade in San Francisco. The cover depicts a political prisoner slumped over. The text reads, "This man subjected himself to imprisonment and probably to being shot or hanged under the new espionage bill." The man in ball chains and stripes on this cover bears a crown of thorns, and again, Christian imagery idolizes the political prisoner, but ignores the prison or other prisoners. The short run of The Blast focused on the legal persecution facing Billings and Mooney, Margaret Sanger, Goldman, the McGahn brothers, and Carlo Tresca. Its pages peppered with advertisements for Berkman's prison memoirs, yet with little about incarceration itself. In the following decades, Berkman expanded his advocacy to support political prisoners in Russia and in exile, working with a number of liberal and leftist organizations to publish essays, testimonials, bulletins. And this was valuable work. Valuable work against the injustices widespread from America's first Red Scare to Russia's Kronstadt Rebellion. Yet again, a common strategy of those contesting state persecution was to distinguish between political and common criminals. In a letter to a fellow advocate, Berkman claimed that the so-called criminal is sociologically a superior type to the average man for his nonconformity. Of the criminal, he wrote, "Heroes are made, great explorers, discoverers, men of daring and initiative." And yet, he continued, "the political is something distinct. A political prisoner seeks not freedom, but revolution and human dignity. As he concluded the letter, in short, you cannot offhand compare politicals with common criminals. Even though Berkman had shifted his approach to prisons while incarcerated, his advocacy for political prisoners resurfaced and reinforced old stratifications, focusing attention again on the ideas of those incarcerated rather than the carceral institutions demanding abolition. Now, Berkman seems to have acknowledged this tension as he returned to the topic of prisons in later writings. Writing across France from Paris to Saint-Tropez in 1928, Berkman confessed lingering frustration over the role of prisons in revolutionary times and in the working argument of his book, Now and After, The ABC of Communist Anarchism. As he wrote to Goldman by letter, I have come to problems that cannot be solved satisfactorily. What is to be done to active enemies and counter-revolutionists? What is to be done with a murderer or raper? What is to be done if mobs were to, he said, make a pogrom in Russia or to lynch a Negro in America? As Berkman explained, each of these hypotheticals might require prison. But as he continued, once we begin with prisons, there is no end to it. Goldman responded, acknowledging, she said, that armed defense is inevitable and justifiable, and yet prisons are not, whatever the offense. We must, Goldman wrote, revalue our conception of human acts. Berkman seemed satisfied with this response. In the resulting book, he stated confidently that revolution must include the destruction of jails, police stations, prisoners liberated, legal documents destroyed. Reconstruction after cannot resort to prisons. Here, perhaps, Berkman glimpsed an anarchist future attentive to both political prisoners and prison politics. In closing, then, I think we should read Berkman with optimism and generosity, appreciative of the nuanced, critical approaches to prison he developed, approaches that I wager are shockingly prescient for anti-prison politics today. But I also see in Berkman's ambivalent anti-prison anarchism a cautionary lesson. Due to the constitutive role that prisons play within American politics, efforts to reform or even abolish penal institutions and practices often unintentionally reinforce other carceral logics. Movements to abolish the death penalty catalyzed the rise in life imprisonment from the 1970s on. Attempts to defund prisons and police often overlook how money is reinvested in surveillance. Even the growing focus on wrongful convictions and exoneration may overlook that the guilty also deserve due process and fair trials. In each of these examples, we struggle to imagine reform that does not fortify the fundamental role of prisons in modern society. Though Alexander Berkman did not live to see that future, his life is no less a worthy guide for those of us working toward it.
Thank you for listening. To help others find Anarchist Essays, please rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts. And if you're interested in anarchist ideas, why not check out the journal Anarchist Studies? For over 20 years, Anarchist Studies has been publishing original research on the history, theory, and practice of anarchism. For more information, visit www.lwbooks.co.uk/anarchist-studies.